I feel like the appreciation aspect and the ability to borrow against the asset is like what I get to keep in what I own. And then I trade that for peace of mind and predictability in the stuff I invest with IHG.
Welcome to the Free From Wall Street podcast, where we share how we have done over $200 million in real estate deals to create, preserve, and pass on generational wealth without the roller coaster ride of the stock market. If you're ready to start investing with purpose, visit freefromwallstreet.com. But for now, let's dive into this episode. Welcome back to the Free From Wall Street podcast. My name is Stephen Libman, and I am with you guys today with my buddy, Aaron Fisher. Aaron, what's going on, brother?
What's up?
So for those of you who don't know, Aaron and I went to college together, have a long history. Aaron was the first IHG investor. He's done a podcast with us before talking about kind of his experience, but it's been a couple years. We've had a lot of growth since then. Some things in his life have changed. So we wanted to come in and do a bit, little bit of a recap. We're going to talk about a couple things. One, his experience, catch up with him, what he's been doing over the last couple of years, talk about stock market and real estate and what the differences are, especially in this inflationary season. Aaron has experience in both. We'll talk about some of the aspects of the fund and some other more close to the heart things, but let's kick it off, man. How you been?
I'm great, brother. Good to see you. Good to speak to you. Ironically, I'm literally in like, I think the same chair and room I was in 2 years ago when we did the podcast. So
there you go.
In that regard, not much has changed, but life goes on.
Yeah. Since then I moved about 800 miles away to a climate. No, it's been good. A lot of changes in the last couple of years, family wise. But yeah, let's dive in. So let's talk about, you know, from last time we spoke till now, kind of what kind of things have been going on.
Yeah, I mean, so the last time we spoke was probably around this time, maybe a little earlier in 2020. So clearly,
mid pandemic
a bit. Yeah, and I mean, as far as investing stuff goes, I mean, I'd say the two things that I've been most heavily involved in have been kind of real estate deals with IHG and then kind of stock and equity planning on my own side that mostly gets filtered through like the company I work for, right? Just a quick recap, I worked for a startup that went public. A lot of my compensation was in equity in the company that vests over time. So you're subject to the market whether you like it or not in some regards. And then there's also that question really of like, what do I do to differentiate my investments?
Yeah. Right? And you probably took stock options over Christmas bonuses because you watched Boiler Room back in the day.
I mean, honestly, some of the best advice I've gotten and that I give to people is like, always ask for more equity.
Right.
Like, it's not about cash. I don't need bonus. Just because like the disparity can be very big if it works out. And then if it doesn't, who cares? Like, you're going to go get a new job anyway. That being said, of course, it's a threshold issue. Like, if you're not making enough money to pay your bills or live a lifestyle you like, you know.
That's what I was going to say is you can tell that to everybody. 90% of the people won't do it because they want to go buy something today versus wait for equity later. And that's a whole different podcast.
But it's so annoying. Yeah, because I mean, people will reach out to me. There's one thing that's like getting the right advice. And then there's like having the gumption to do it.
Yeah.
So like most of this stuff is difficult because you have to go back to somebody and ask for something that you think it's uncomfortable, but in reality, it's just how business works, right? How many times have we negotiated the price of, you know, a house we sold or a car you buy, whatever. It's just the way it works. Like, it's just how to ask is usually the problem.
Right. The answer will always be no if you don't ask.
No, always. It's more like no one does anything. Well, some people do, but very rarely is someone looking out for your best interests without you putting it on the table. It's just like a human nature kind of thing. So I don't even think the answer is no if you don't ask. It's just like there is no movement unless you are the catalyst.
Yeah. To that point, we always like to give book recommendations. Never Split the Difference, one of my favorite books on negotiation. Chris Voss is a beast. I know you've read his stuff, and the Black Swan Group is
a funny anecdote there. We actually hired him to give like a talk at our, you know, yearly sales meeting. Oh, cool. So when I saw the deal come in, I was like, I'm negotiating this one.
Right. That's amazing. I love it.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. To be honest, I found his book way better than a presentation, but that's just personally. I found myself reading the book and going, I think I might write a book about negotiation. Cause like it, if this is what's helpful to people, I feel like I know all this. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is a top selling, none of this is like revolutionary to me.
No, what I like about it is that he just gives practical, tactical things, yeah. Right? And that's what people need. They need to distill it down, those concepts, into practical.
But I think to his point, or that is raising, is like, you got to go do it though.
Yeah, you have to go practice it, right? You got to change your neural pathways.
Yeah, you have to challenge people. You have to say no. That goes like against what makes people comfortable, but it's
reps
growth, honestly.
Yeah, and it's reps under the bar, right? You do it more, the more comfortable it becomes, the easier it is, and then you start to see the fruit.
It's also a little, you know, you might like this term, but like a leap of faith. Like you have to do it to see that it works.
Yeah.
You can't see that it works first, and that, you know what I mean? Like
there's only so much that you can understand cerebrally before you actually go put it into practice and then see it work and then go, aha, like I believe it now.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I think a lot of like personal growth comes from that kind of mindset of you kind of got to believe and trust in the process before you see the outcome. Reps under the bar is a great probably analogy because I mean, it's different in a gym, but it's like people there with huge muscles didn't walk in there with them. Right.
Right.
But you can see the transformation. I just think a lot of things that happen on the inside, it's hard for the outside to see. So you tend to dismiss it a little bit.
Yeah.
And to be honest, that's one thing our friendship has shown me. Like you've changed a bunch as a person since we were in college. It's possible. And what does it is internally motivated. Other people don't see it. I'm sure you get it too. And they're like, oh yeah, you're hanging out with Aaron still. Like,
yeah.
What are you bums doing?
Right. Life is different since Boston University.
Yeah.
But I just did a town hall. So I do a monthly town hall where I do some training for the team. And this is what we talked about. We talked about growth mindset. Like, what are you doing? And I think what was important takeaways was one, people don't really need to be taught. They need to be reminded. Like it's, we probably have a good amount of knowledge that we're not applying yet. And then two is, if you don't have any time set aside in your calendar for growth, then you shouldn't expect to grow. I think it's ridiculous that people are like, they think that they're going to grow automatically. When I asked my team, I was like, raise your hand if you have growth on your calendar, like a time carved out to read, learn, grow, whatever. And it's important. So, you know, we make sure that we try to put that time in there.
Because I will. Yeah, I agree.
Automatically.
And I'll say I've noticed more than ever lately that just people who are, I admire for being really good at something, like no matter how much innate talent they've had, they've also worked really hard at it.
Yeah. Nothing.
And I think that's the point you're making. Like, to be honest, a lot of the changes I've made personally have all come from purposeful, meaningful time devoted to it.
Yep.
So like my daily stuff, and I'm nowhere near where I think I want to be, but I do like daily affirmations in the morning. And I also, a good friend, this is maybe my favorite thing. And then I heard the same person that told, like referred this to me. I heard someone ask them, and they're a workaholic. Like they get things done. Asked, hey, what's like one practice you did that made the biggest change? And I think this is for me too. And it's so easy. It's every morning you write down three things you're grateful for, but you cannot repeat them. And the idea is that you only do it for a year and like you wake up just feeling grateful and that's a better mindset. I've been doing it for like 6 years straight. And like, sure, I repeat some or whatever, but the practice of thinking about what you're grateful for every day, especially to begin the day, is such a good thing in your mind. And the beauty of not repeating it is you end up realizing how grateful you are for little things.
So many things. I know a really successful business guy as well that does this. And at the end of every year, he like catalogs these, you know, journals essentially of just his, you know, three or four things that he was grateful for. And then in the last week of the year, he'll go back and just read through them. And it's just an overwhelming sense of gratitude of all of the good things that he has in his life. And that's the focus versus the, what do I lack? What am I missing? What does somebody else have that I don't? It really focuses on that. My 5-year-old, every night she goes to bed, she prays, "Thank you, Lord, for an attitude of gratitude and bravery."
That's my favorite
thing. She doesn't need bravery, but the attitude of gratitude I'm so impressed with, because she recognizes that you can feel lack or you can have an attitude of gratitude. So
that's good stuff. The one I like is gratitude is the attitude.
Yeah, I like it. Well, so this is, it's a good start. So let's pivot a little bit into the investing journey of like stocks and real estate. So you mentioned before, like you invest with us, obviously you have your own stock portfolio. You also own some individual real estate that you are a landlord on. So let's talk about what you're liking, what you're seeing, what you're not liking in all those different kind of facets.
Yeah, I think start with probably stocks because that's the least like what you guys do. The beauty of it is that I think it's a thing that can have the highest return in the quickest amount of time, right? The corollary to that is the highest risk. You can also just lose it all any day for any given reason. I'd also say you have
30% returns, right? The other year in 2000, was it 19 or 20?
I mean, it depends how you get into things, but I mean, I've definitely made like way bigger than that and lost bigger than that in, you know, even in like a day, if you're trading options or whatever. But if you look at something like as simple as like the GameStop thing that happened, right? Which was basically like a Reddit revolution on overexposing what investors were doing. I won't get into the nitty gritty too much, but the idea is like the market has a lot of outside factors that you don't think about until they affect your money, really, right? And these are things you can't control or predict. And that's both scary and beneficial. So what I've found in that world is like, I don't have the stomach to ride too much of like my daily whatever on this roller coaster, whatever you want to call it. So I do have money in the stock market. They're based on things that I think will happen long in the future, because, you know, statistically it's like you want the larger amount of data set you have, the less any statistical like abnormality that happens matters over time, right? So something like a crash or this GameStop thing, it's like, well, over a 20-year period, it might not matter.
Right.
Just examples of like what's wrong. What's great is you can, you know, buy an option on something and by the end of the week, you made 10x your money. So I think, you know, it's high risk, high reward, but I've learned for myself that like the risk part is a little too much. I'm not trying to go broke. I've been there. I'm not trying to go back, just the way it is. So I don't want all my money in there. Then there's like the middle ground of like kind of the real estate I own myself. What's nice, you know, what I've always liked about real estate is like you can, especially when you own it yourself, there's, yeah, I own property I rent out, but I also own the property. So I have equity in the property that I can borrow against to make money. And what's really cool for you know, IHG and myself is now I'm at a level where I think all the money I have invested with you guys is money we've made together off of a property that I borrowed against. So it's all just income on top of income from borrowing against a property I own. So I think that's a big, like for me anyway, that is a big differentiator in stuff I own versus stuff I invest in. The problem there is there's no such thing as like no touch if you own the place, because the buck stops with you, right? So for example, today, and I'm not mad at this, this is what I signed up for and I'm happy to do it. One of my properties, a tenant's moving out. I got to get someone else in there. I got to go over there today. I like showing the property myself so I can get a relationship with the tenant. They get to know me. I get to know them before they move in. I think it makes a better relationship. I do use a real estate agent to help set this stuff up. I pay them, right? So this is like, I look at it like, all right, if I have to work 1 week every 3 years or whatever for this, it's no problem.
Right.
For some nice passive income on an asset I own and can borrow against, totally worth the trade.
Yeah.
But it does require work and it requires a stomach. Like the past 18 months, I've had to, you know, put in a new washer dryer for the tenant, various other things. So it's like you have to be prepared to deal with that stuff, right?
Yeah.
But I do think there's like a nice, the asset can appreciate, you're making monthly income on it in the meantime. That I love. And then I'd say the third avenue I really have is the stuff with you guys, which is the most, I feel like the most passive. I do nothing other than wire you money and give you wire instructions on how to get it back, or fill, you know, sign some paperwork in the beginning, whatever. And then it's also feels kind of like the, I don't know if safest is the right word, but like the most, predictable.
Yeah.
You know, the stock market, obviously not predictable. Anyone who tells you that is full of it.
Right.
Renting your own property is predictable, but not in like the daily or weekly aspect, right? Like my phone can ring at any time and it's like, this doesn't work, or someone broke in the house, whatever.
So do you manage that yourself, right? You don't have a manager that takes the phone calls or collects the rent or anything like that?
Yeah. Correct. The tenant calls me, but I don't do any like the repair work myself.
Sure.
But I kind of manage the relationship on both sides.
Yep. Okay.
I mean, I want to know what's up, and the property size isn't really big enough where paying a manager makes all that much sense. Versus then I was going to say, that's really the benefit with you guys, right? It's like the stuff I invest in with you, I'm sure issues come up all the time. I never have to hear about it. I just get a check every month. That's the beauty of that. So it's been nice. And like, honestly, as time's gone on, I've been wanting to rebalance things out of the stock side. That's a little more like volatile for my liking. But ironically, how I made most of the money, right, was through the equity from the company I work with, into like the other avenues that are both like either more controllable or, like I said, just feel more hands off and predictable.
Yep. Yeah, no, it's all good stuff. And, you know, obviously the name of our podcast doesn't talk a lot about stocks, but the reality of the matter is that there's almost $5 trillion in the stock market from just 401ks. Like, people are very heavily into it. It's been good. It's been bad. We've talked a few times on the podcast about like how my dad lost a bunch of money before he passed away and that. And I know people that have become millionaires on it.
Yeah.
Because they bet the right time at the right place. So I think diversification is key in all of this stuff, right? I don't think
100%.
And then you have to be smart about how the times change. My kids are yelling in the background. That's what happens when you record from home. And, you know, the ups and downs that come, you know, if you can stomach them and you have longer time left in life, right? Like the last couple of, you know, weeks have been pretty volatile for the stock market, right? And I'm sure that you were able to stomach that a lot better than somebody that was days away from retirement, right?
Yeah.
Like, it just depends on the timing of your life too, like what you can handle and what kind of tolerance you have. For sure.
The other thing that is honestly kind of nice in building up that tolerance is kind of forced upon you as an employee of these companies. You can only trade during certain windows, right? So you're, as an employee, you're considered an insider. So everyone's heard of insider trading. So there's certain times where you can't buy or sell the stock for your company for insider trading purposes. When there's big swings on those days, that's when you build up this tolerance. Because I can't panic sell, or I can't sell high.
Yeah, so right. You have to
get
chill.
Used to, yeah, you can't do anything. So you kind of get used to this helplessness, which is the reality, I feel. So like, to me, I look at it like there's like three lanes of what I talked about. Like, one is potentially infinite growth with potentially ultimate loss. And in that, I want to invest over for a long period of time. All of these are really long period of time things. The other two, like real estate I own and real estate with IHG, have the component of like a regular monthly payment. So those are kind of shared. I have to take more responsibility with property I own. I mean, even if I hired a property manager, I still have to manage them. So there is no like no touch. Plus they make some money, so, and it comes out of my pocket. So there's a trade-off there. So there's like both of those have a monthly, and then I feel like the appreciation aspect and the ability to borrow against the asset is like what I get to keep in what I own. And then I trade that for kind of like peace of mind and predictability in the stuff I invest with IHG.
Yeah.
And those are like the three lanes.
No, I love it. And it's well diversified and it gives you a lot more options than if you had all your eggs in one basket. So,
yeah, I mean, that's the, we talked about that last time. Like anyone who is betting all in on one thing, I get worried that like even when they win, they think they outsmarted everything and like are just going to do it again until eventually, right, that it doesn't pay off. Yeah, one thing I'd say I've learned is like, or seen, I should say, is like the need for humans to make correlations of things. So it's like you made money on a bet on the stock market, and now you think you knew something because of that. And it's like the market went up for reasons who knows.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We're so like, you can bet on good companies. And then, you know, what's happened recently with like tech, where that's kind of the market I'm in. It's like the world just went, you know, as rates go up, we're kind of valuing all these things off their future potential. And when we're talking about borrowing money and rates go up, the future potential goes down. So it's not like the companies have, it's not a performance issue with the company. It's a macroeconomic aspect of the world and borrowing that you can't really predict into how it'll affect prices when you're in like a very long or very short term view of it.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it happens in real estate too. I mean, you know, we bought a property, I don't know, 18 months ago that we're under contract to sell right now. And like, why are we selling now? It's not because we were geniuses. I mean, we bought a good deal, but it was the market helped pump it up to where we're seeing year five pro formas in 18 months. And it makes sense to sell now. It would be naive to think that we did something special or great when really the market has carried everybody, right? And I think—
Yes.
I think there's going to be a lot of learning that's going to take place over the next probably 2 years from guys who have not been in a downturn yet, have not seen a market cycle yet, or haven't had to underwrite to a sensitivity of higher interest rates in 2 years than it's going to be today. So I think there's going to be a lot of learning that goes on. Luckily, we've been through that and we partner with guys that are 30, 40 years in the business to offset and hedge against that a little bit, but it's not missed on us that we're not the best real estate operators because the real estate market went up, right? And I think that that's kind of to your point, what people can sometimes get caught up in, which is, oh yeah, look, I won, I'll continue to win. It's like—
I think a specialist thought, like, you're just pushing buttons on a screen and making money.
Right.
You're like, shh, I could do this.
Yeah, I mean, for instance, I've only made one stock trade in my entire life.
Really?
And it was, I opened an account and I bought, I don't know, 20 grand of Tesla right before they came out with some announcement, right? And the quarterly announcement, and they had high expectations. And I rode that wave for 10 days. I sold it the day before the announcement because it was all hype. It came back down about 30%, but I doubled my money in 10 days and I've never traded another stock again. And all it was big boy gambling, right? I just knew that the market was going to react to
one way or the other.
Yeah. Right. And it was like, historically, this is what's happened, right? They seem to have good outsized earnings. I don't think that's going to matter. But yeah, but that didn't make me be like, I should day trade because that wasn't based on anything other than when the mailman wants to buy Tesla, right? Or get out of Tesla. Like they always say, like, when the mailman wants to buy this, get out of that. Like, you know, Warren Buffett always talks about being greedy when people are fearful and fearful when people are greedy.
100%. I mean, that's the talk now. It's like the market's down. You should invest now. And I'm like, the person telling me that, did you take all your money out 6 months ago? You saw this coming?
Right.
Then maybe I'll listen to you because like you know the future. Otherwise, you're just kind of regurgitating what is good for those who make money running the stock market want you to believe, which is it's always a good time to put money into it because right. I get paid a fee no matter what happens to your money.
Yeah. And you've talked to Chris, our new head of investor relations, and yeah, you know, he's come from a 25-year background in wealth management. And yeah, I mean, you can talk dollar cost averaging all day and say, well, if you put more money with me now, it will go further later. And there could be some truth to that. But at the end of the day, Fidelity, Wells Fargo, Citibank, these companies make money off of assets under management. The more money you give them, the more money that they make. So it's good for them, right? So
I don't know if I've told you this. I may have, if I'm repeating a story from the previous podcast, hopefully you can edit it out, but I don't think so. Really good anecdote on this. So I went to law school, right? I'm an attorney. Most people don't think that, whatever. And in law school, you meet people from all different walks of life. So it's like, no one really went on to do what I did, and people go on to get into government, whatever. So one of my classmates got into, you know, he was working at like Merrill Lynch or whatever, one of these big iBanks or whatever. And he hit me up right around when we started our business, right? And he was like, hey, I'm just hitting up people. I like the guy. Hey, I'll talk to you. I want to, you know, you to give me some money to invest, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, no way. And he's like, why not? I'm like, because, dude, if you make 10% on the money I give you, you're going to think you did a great job. And it's like, it's not going to matter to me because I had no money at the time. Right? We're talking about maybe 25,000 I could invest that I'd have to borrow from somewhere.
Right.
It's like, and if you lose it, you're just going to blame it on something else. And I literally told him, like, I think I like real estate better. And he kind of laughed at me and was like, all right. And I told him what we were going to do. I got a friend. We're going to borrow against this property, flip some houses.
Yep.
And I remember him kind of laughing at it and then checking back with me in a year and being like, so how did that, like, I just think he thought I wasn't going to do it.
Yeah.
And he checked back with me in a year and I was like, I've made, I don't know what it was, $80,000 profit.
Right.
Off of someone else's money. Like, maybe I should teach you how to manage money.
Right.
Which, and none of that's to brag. It's just to say, like, that the market has this, like, mentality of, like, everything's a no-brainer and not everyone makes money. So,
no, quite the opposite. A lot of people lose money. Businesses go out of business every day. Like, I mean, there's a lot of, I just shared this with my team. Like, we celebrated 10 years last year, and for one reason or another, 4% of businesses last 10 years or more. 4%. Yeah. Like, that's overwhelming in terms of, and there's various reasons why things go out of business, right? It's not just like only the good survive 10 years. Like, people shut down their business on purpose after 5 years. That's fine.
100%. But
it was an interesting statistic because that means a lot of businesses start, right? And not all of them are successful. And luckily, you know, we picked something that I knew very well from having a lot of real estate experience, right? And you had real estate experience too. And so it was, we hedged ourselves a little bit. And
yeah, I mean, that's awesome, dude. 10 years is nuts. I would say too, the one thing that maybe set you up for that is I think you always had the vision that this was a lifelong plan, like versus opening a hot dog stand and see where it goes. Kind of, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, my wife and I just talked about this. There was multiple times through the struggles of the early years where I was like, I'll just go get a job. And she like would smirk and be like, don't threaten me. Like, I know you're not going to get a job. Yeah. And I was like, I'm not threatening. But she was like, you know, one thing that I thought was always interesting was you never had a plan B. There wasn't like, well, if this doesn't work out, I'll go do this. And it was like, it really didn't cross my mind.
It's kind of important, honestly.
Like, I think it is. I think for anybody to be successful, like, it's a bad analogy, right? But it's like having a prenup before you get married. Like, you're already setting yourself up for thinking about the failure. A plan B in business is the same thing. Like, well, if this doesn't work out, then this would happen. And it's like, or you can just go into it and say, I'm going to make it work
regardless. I think it has more to do, yeah, like the devotion of what it takes to make anything successful is like knowing there'll be difficult times that you're willing to push through. And if you're not devoted, I just think you don't push through the difficult times.
Yeah.
Right. It can come from like different reasons. Like, you could just be so convicted you want to be a business owner, have no other options, but this is like the one thing that has to work out. I've definitely found that true in my life. And like, it wasn't always because I was so devoted. It was like, well, the option of quitting and finding another job doesn't sound like a great idea right now.
Right.
I really think like that's the, like I always say, like when we hire or whatever, and when I give advice to others to hire, like, yeah, I have a great job, but it's stressful sometimes. And there's got to be stuff about it that will get me through the parts that are stressful. Because if not, you're just going to leave.
Right.
And that's kind of the idea with like a prenup and a marriage, where it's like when things are going to get tough at some point. And if you have an easy way out, you might take it versus right. making it work.
Yeah, 100%. No, it's a great analogy. Cool. So we have a couple more minutes left here. Yeah. One thing that we always like to talk about, and I know that it's something that you and I talk about a lot offline, is just the aspect of, you know, moving from success to significance. And as we are able to offset some need in the world, You know, so talk to us a little bit about, you know, philanthropy, where that sits on your mind. Why is it important to you? And obviously, we talk about our donor advised fund a lot and how that matters with the profits from the business. But interested to see from your perspective, kind of what's important, what you're focusing on and how that's working.
Yeah, no, great. I mean, I should have said, to be honest, like when I'm making these three distinctions, that's another thing I like about investing with IHG. It's funny because maybe I don't highlight it enough. Like I'm just like, oh, look, I got this check. But it is nice to know that like that investment is also helping out other people. I think it comes from a place of like, I think most of us are like this. Like most people want to help other people. We just don't know how. That's definitely the case for me. So my philanthropic side is more about, unfortunately, being like a blank check, or not blank check, but I think you know the term better than me, but I'm writing checks. I'm not in the field as much. A lot of that has to do with, I don't really know who's doing the best work. I will say I have done some cool things, especially with like American Cancer Society. In the past, I threw a, for those who don't know, I have like a small entertainment law practice, and I threw a benefit concert with some of the artists I work with, raised a bunch of money for ACS, and that felt amazing. That was like probably one of the things I'm more proud about that I've done, because the reaction that got me was the American Cancer Society being like, wait, you raised how much money? And to me, it was like, yeah, it was never going to be less than that. You know what I mean? Yeah. Another nice thing, like the company I work for, Datadog, by the way, like they've been great with a lot of help with that regard, like either matching donations or just making charitable donations on the company's behalf into like a lot of things that I think we believe in our company culture, like either diversity or things going on in Ukraine that you can help make an impact in people's lives. And then, you know, it's another nice thing to see that it's really more about the collective of community. For example, like there's one charity as a company through employees choosing to donate.
Yeah.
Right. We raised like over $1 million for a specific charity. No employee themselves, I think, was even able to give over $1,000.
Right.
So it just shows like together how much you can raise or impact. And then another thing I do, I would say more hands-on-ish, is really from a career perspective, I guess. Like I'm always helping students or talking at like a conference if I'm asked. I have one tomorrow. But like linking people together, I think, is like a very strong skill of mine. Mm-hmm. And all it takes is a little effort. And sometimes it doesn't work out, but other times it does. Like, so I try to use that too. That, I don't know if that's exactly what you're talking about, but it is when it makes a difference for someone else, right?
Yeah,
they're sure. Like, thank you so much. I literally just wrote an email and said what I think is true about you.
Yeah.
That you're a good person. I would hire you, but we don't have the staff, but you're looking. Just little things like that. I think like being human and a lot of it comes from too, like when you've reached what you think is like a level of success, you kind of realize like it's not about me getting even further, or just, it's not just about that. Right. So that's kind of my philosophy on it. I would like to find some things I can be a little more hands-on involved in, but I mean, it's hard with like the career I have. So I always look at it as like, if I'm good at making money or whatever, then I should give some of that money to people who will put it to good use better than I will.
Yeah. Like, no, we agree. I mean, I won't be able to be on the front lines of every place around the world that we want to go donate to, right? But if we can support the people doing great work by writing a check, then, you know, I think there's, you know, this year we'd like to do a kind of like a corporate trip with us and all of our families and let the investors know like, hey, we're going to go build some houses down in Mexico for a couple of days if you guys want to come, right? I think it would be pretty cool for us to all
do that
as team building. Like, but there's nothing wrong being the rope holder, right? Like there's a famous missionary that said, I'll go down into the pit if you will hold the rope. Check writers are rope holders. These guys can't go do what they need to do without people that are writing the checks, right? And it took me a little bit of time to understand that there is nobility in that, just as there is going out onto the front lines. Like it was pretty cool. We have a guy that we support who was in the Ukraine for the last couple of years before the war broke out. And he called us up and he was like, hey, I need 3 vans and like 100 bulletproof vests, because I literally have guys that are climbing into vans and just driving women and children out of the city every day.
Yeah.
And we were like, okay. He was like, if I could get 3 vans and this many vests, like this is how many people a day we can pull out. And we were like, okay, what's that look like? Right. And how do we help? And then one of the coolest things is, now that we run multiple, we help with multiple nonprofits, was we couldn't get vests. We could maybe write the check for vests, but I don't know where to get vests, right? There's supply chain issues. There's all kinds of issues going on. So we called another guy who I know runs kind of a different nonprofit only in war zone. So, and he was a former military guy. And I said, hey, this guy needs like a container of vests. Like, can I just put you in contact with him? 3 days later, there's a container of vests. And this guy figured out through his supplier how to do it. And it was just, and that was to your point, just making the connection. Like, I don't know how to help here, but maybe these guys could work something out.
Yeah.
And it did something amazing, right? That's just awesome. Because we thought it through and just said, oh, maybe this person can help. So,
yeah, I'd say, honestly, I think part of my guilt comes from being an attorney and not really using that as much, because there will be things that come up where it's like just having the license to practice law is probably enough to help out some people.
Yeah.
So that's maybe something like when I have more time, I would like to do a little better. You know, like if someone's wrongfully arrested but can't afford an attorney, it's like they should be able to get help anyway.
Not from a overworked public defender.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is like immigration issues or things like that, that I mean, that's maybe the naivete and part of like my, I don't know, self-arrogance that's always been good for me usually is this idea that like, why can't I do that? I should be able to figure out how to help. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
It might be really difficult work. I don't know, but I just assume I could figure it out and be helpful.
I'm going to be honest. It's been a lot of what's attributed ourselves to some success too, is you don't know what you don't know. So you're like, you know, we just launched our $100 million fund, right? I was like, you know what we should do? We should launch a $100 million fund. That way we can have money to deploy ready to go. And there was 6 months of brain damage that I did not know was coming down the pike. But because I didn't know, and I was already in the mix, you know, I wasn't going to stop. Like, I was like, all right, now here's a new problem to solve. Let's go solve it and let's move on.
How much do you think, this is like not planned, and usually you're interviewing the guest probably, but I'm curious because I've been toying with this. How much do you think like the things you do know are an impediment to starting like either over or in a new direction? Like, for example, for me, I get recruited all the time to join another early stage startup and try to do what we, you know, like support their growth. And it's like,
but you know what it looks like now.
Oh my God. It's so, it's like staring at a mountain.
You've seen how the sausage is made. Like, it's, yeah, you can't unsee that, right? And that's part of the thing. Like, if somebody asked me again, like, hey, would you go back a year and do this again? Like, probably not. I was just dumb enough to do it the first time.
Right.
So I think it plays a big piece of it. I tried to not allow it to frame my future perspective, because there's also new technologies and new things that probably will make that easier in the future. So I try not to let it overwhelm like my logical side, but certainly the more you see and the more you recognize that it comes from hard work and it comes from dedication, it comes from these things that you can't fake, like you have to do, then then yeah, you're maybe not less likely. I mean, maybe I love a challenge. So it's not to say that I wouldn't start a company or do this again. It was just, but it would have to be for the absolute right thing.
Yeah.
Right?
To me, it actually goes to what I was saying before about like what it's going to take for you to persevere through the tough stuff.
Right.
So it's like, it's not
the juice worth the squeeze.
Yeah. Now like, we know, well, now I know what's going to come up, if, you know, like what I'm going to have to get through. So I know up front I need to ask for things that will motivate me to get through it. And like as life goes on, those things change for people, right? Like maybe in the beginning it's money, then it's time with family, then it's whatever, and different things for different people. But it's like now I know to ask that those things will be in place, and they've changed. And that's kind of, I think, the challenge in that regard is you're getting asked to help by people that don't know. And it's like, unfortunately, one of the things I know is Yeah, you know it's difficult. I'm not talking about like the academic side of difficulty. I'm talking about the like, I'm going to quit because this is too much work or too much stress or whatever difficult yeah. that it's a blessing to get to that point, but you need something to, like I said, like push you through it. So, yeah. and that's going to change.
You know, I think what's also interesting, the dichotomy to that is you now have the skill set to probably make that easier for this next company.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So like you also need to make sure that you're rewarded and compensated properly for those things because you know how to overcome and you know how to do some of that. So it's the skill set that you've acquired, right? And now like some people ask me like, how do I underwrite a deal? And I'm like, well, it's do you have 10 years? Like, how do you properly underwrite a deal or how do you back in the napkin it? Like there's a lot of things that go into like, how do I underwrite a deal? But yeah, it's certainly easier for me to underwrite a deal today than it was 10 years ago.
That's a good point. I don't really factor that in enough that like, you wouldn't be as stressed out because you know more.
Yeah, you've collected a lot of wisdom and your own data set and things that you can lean on to make life probably easier. But what are you getting in trade for that, you know, in response to that experience? And that is the number one thing. I mean, that's why we pick our sponsors that we partner with is like they have 30 years experience through high interest rates, through inflation. Like these guys know how to pivot and move through those things. So how much more valuable are they than the new guys, right?
I find it too interesting. Like it really helps me decide like who is worth talking to or partnering with or getting a relationship with based on their understanding of how to value that experience. Right. Like, cause some people reach out to you, hey, I value all this knowledge you have. And then they make you an offer as if you don't have that.
Right.
And it's like, I'm sorry. I thought we were talking about, you know, what I have that other people don't, that you value that, not I should give it away. You know what I mean?
And it's such a conundrum because these startups don't have the capital to pay for it, but they don't have the ability to not pay for it. It's going to cost you more to not pay the right person. Like that's something that I've learned very
totally agree with
time is like, I will overpay for experience. You know what I would consider overpay, right? Not what the person probably receiving it feels, but like it's that you can't afford not to.
Yeah. It's not just that a you probability. You're more likely to have success with someone who has seen it and done it than someone who has to figure it out. It is bizarre to me sometimes where it's just like, to be honest, like to not be cynical about it, I just look at it as like, these are not my type of people, right? Like I wouldn't, it's not about the money and stuff, but like if they don't understand the proposition, right, then it's not my cup of tea.
Yeah. And I've said this multiple times, like you're going to pay for it as a business owner one way or the other. Right. Yeah. So you want to pay for it in mistakes. You want to pay for it in time. You want to pay for it in experience. And I'll choose experience every single time to cut that line.
And in our world, it's more about time. It's like, I don't think other people can't figure it out or wouldn't or whatever. But when you're relying on like super growth quarter after quarter and numbers, not in like, well, this person's doing better. Like, no, I need to see like revenue growth. Time is really the factor that I think companies can't afford to lose. Because it's not like, hey, I could find someone, you could find somebody, and in 18 months, train them up and blah, blah, or you could hire me today.
Right. Yeah, or you can hire a rock star A player that'll come out of the gate, not need to be managed and show you what to do versus you as the business. And I see entrepreneurs make this mistake all the time where they're like, well, I'm going to learn this aspect of the business, that I'm gonna hire somebody and I'm gonna train them. And it's like, you just became your own bottleneck. You have no idea that you did that. And you won't for another 5 or 10 years.
To be honest, it's been like my secret to success in real estate is not paying people that know more than me. I mean, you've seen this across the board for me. When we were flipping houses, if someone asked me to like hang a cabinet, I'd be like, are you sure you want me doing this? Like, I'm not good at this. We were paying people to do it. Or like I always felt the best at finding deals. Why on earth should I go, oh, I'll just do it myself and save a couple bucks? No, it's in my opinion. Yeah. You get the collective benefit of having people who are experts at what they do is way better than like saving a few bucks on the back end.
Yep.
The irony, I think, in business is that often the things that upfront cost more end up giving you a better return anyway. So it's not even bad for business.
Nope.
You know what I mean?
It's perception. It's your own perception.
Yeah, you didn't save money. You made less.
Right. It'll cost you something. Life lessons with Aaron Fisher.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, I love it. I appreciate you jumping on. I think we've covered pretty much everything that we wanted to. Any parting shots you want to take?
Definitely not shots. Yeah. You know, one thing I'd like to say is I recently got, you guys sold a property that I had invested in. I got my money back. That was a really cool feeling. I think for me, I was actually traveling. And when I was younger, a lot of cool stuff in life is like you visualizing something happening and then it really happening.
Yeah.
And I always thought like making money on vacation just sounds like something I want as part of my life. Like I want the ability to do that. And like, look, obviously it's just the timing of it. And like, it's a passive investment I don't really do much for, but it was cool to be like, oh yeah, from this Italian villa that I was at for my cousin's wedding, I got to send you guys wiring instructions to get this money. That made me happy. And it was also nice to like, you know, having a return or an exit, however you want to say it, on something I don't have to manage.
Yeah.
Beautiful. That's the beauty of it.
That's awesome. Oh, man, we were super excited too. So for those of you listening, that was, we sold 120 units down in Dallas, Texas. We sold it early again because the market was kind to us. So we hit some good pro forma numbers and we're able to return capital. And our three prong philosophy is always preservation of capital first, return of capital, like how am I getting it back, and return on investment. We take care of numbers one and two, number three will take care of itself. And no, it's great to hear. I remember shooting you a text and you're like, I love this. I'm in Italy. And yeah, you guys are going to be wiring me some cash. So
yeah. And what's the beauty of it is the passiveness, because when the thought came up, I was working at a record label, and long story short, the lawyer representing an artist we were signing, they got another deal. We ended up paying them double our initial offer. And I knew the guy was writing his emails from vacation on a beach. I knew how much more money the guy just made. And I was like,
right,
damn, I want to make, you know, it was 10 grand. It wasn't crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the time, especially when you're broke, you're like 10 grand from the beach. This guy's got the life. But then I realized the counterpart to that was he had to work on vacation. That kind of sucks. So right. This felt a little better than that.
I love it, man. Well, always appreciate chatting with you and going through. We always end up on like personal growth and mindset stuff with it, which I love. Yeah. And yeah, always appreciate your trust with your hard earned money. Looking forward to do many more deals in the future together.
Absolutely. And, yeah. Congrats.
Yeah, man. Thank you so much. And let's obviously stay in touch.
Yeah. All right, brother. No doubt. All right. Bye, guys.
Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Free From Wall Street podcast. If you like what you hear, leave us a rating and review and let us know what you think.